KALW.
All of a sudden, they told us we're going to have to close the libraries.
When city services shut their doors last March, many employees were assigned new jobs to help fight the pandemic.
My skills really matched well with what they needed, especially being bilingual.
Today, we meet a San Francisco librarian turned contact tracer. Then, writer Aidan Thomas on making history as a trans author.
Society doesn't get to decide who you are. You decide who you are. When you know who you are, the magic knows who you are.
And we hear a reading from a children's book about surviving hard times.
It's a story about Cody, a little caterpillar born in the midst of a terrible thunderstorm, and his long journey that follows.
That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, we're starting with a story from our series, At Work, looking at how our jobs have changed.
I have a lot of pride in my work.
How do you do it?
Sprays, masks, gloves.
I'm with the Swamp Team.
Hi, my friends, and how are you?
It's nice now with technology.
Pandora's box has been opened.
It's a beautiful way to make your living, but it's more work than I ever imagined.
Last year, in early March, San Francisco Public Library employees got an email telling them the library was closing in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. They were furloughed and they were told to go home. But that wasn't all. The email also told them they'd be reassigned to work as part of the city's disaster response. They learned that this could mean a lot of different things, from working in food banks to staffing shelters to joining the Department of Public Health's contact tracing program. For this edition of our series, At Work, Annalise Finney spoke with one of these disaster service workers, a librarian who now leads teams of contact tracers for the Department of Public Health.
Until early March, Ramses Escobedo spent his days coordinating library events like Aztec dance classes, helping people find books, and overseeing a staff of librarians. He'd been working in libraries for a long time, since soon after he arrived in the Bay Area from Jerez, Zacatecas, Mexico.
So I came here permanently when I was 17. I got a job as a busboy. And then I had a cousin who working in the San Jose Public Library system. And he said, hey, why don't you just try to get a job here, you know. So in San Jose, I was a page, a library clerk.
He worked his way up to become the manager of San Francisco's Excelsior branch. And that's where he was last March.
All of a sudden, they told us we're going to have to close the libraries.
So, like everyone else, Ramses went home. He Googled how to install shelves, and then he installed shelves. He cataloged his vast collection of digital photos, especially the ones from his wedding last year. He cooked food and watched The Mandalorian with his wife.
We're like going crazy because it's so good.
When Ramses got his disaster relief reassignment email, he had some options about what his new role would be. Contact tracing stood out to him.
I thought that librarians would be adept to doing this job well. Libraries are a community hub. We know how to relate to people and create rapport. My skills really matched well with what they needed, especially being bilingual.
For weeks, Ramses sat in Zoom rooms and learned how exactly contact tracing works. When someone gets a positive test, the city calls them and asks them who they were recently in contact with. Those people then get calls from contact tracers like Ramses.
I think in most cases, at least in my experience, they knew already. In most cases, it's a family member and they knew. So the shock is not really there, right? But when they don't know, of course, there's some shock and, you know, you can just hear their concern, you know, in their voices, and they want to know who and when. You try to highlight what's the positive of us calling, you know, basically saying, well, you know, we're here to assist you with any needs that you may have, provide you guidance if you have any questions.
Ramses tries to help people quarantine by connecting them with free food, cleaning supplies, and hotel rooms if they need them in order to separate from other people.
Vamos a empezar aquí nosotros. Buenas tardes y bienvenidos al turno nocturno de rastreo de contactos. Nos faltan varios compañeros.
As San Francisco cases spiked, the city hired more tracers. Ramses was promoted to be a team lead, and now he and another librarian run contact tracing teams in Spanish, which enable people who are fluent in Spanish but speak limited English to work as tracers.
The Latino community has been impacted disproportionately.
This means that in order for contact tracers to slow the spread, they need to be particularly good at building trust within Spanish-speaking communities.
It's much easier to create rapport with close contact if they identify themselves with the contact tracer who's calling.
This connection makes a difference.
I remember calling a Spanish-speaking father, and I'm trying to tell him, we're going to ask you to stay in quarantine. And, he's like, yeah. And then in the background, I think he had me in speakerphone in Spanish. It's all in Spanish. I just hear like, yeah, you tell him. I tell him all the time to stay indoors and take care of himself, not to go out. You tell him now. And then there was a big pause between the gentleman and I. And then I'm just like, I think somebody just threw you under the bus, kind of. And then we started laughing because it's like, yeah, that's my daughter. I was like, well, she's not wrong. So, I would follow what she's saying because she's correct. And I almost could feel like, all right, I'll do it. Okay.
Ramses's work days are long, and for him, it's a big change to be at a desk all day.
I joke around sometimes with the tracers that, there's a the pancake butt effect. Like, you feel like you have no butt. Oh, my God, he's starting to smell so good.
This
What's
smells
up?
Good, too, the grapefruit.
When I asked Ramses how he balances so much time in front of the computer, he talked about evenings cooking with his wife.
Which is... try to have fun with each other, even with menial work.
The race is done. I'll just leave it on the
Yeah, that was really fast. You know, even with washing dishes, or you put some music on, and she, you know, if it's a good song, she comes and starts dancing around me, and so I reciprocate as well as I can. It sounds good to me.
When I picture Ramses returning to the Excelsior Branch Library, it feels a bit like the closing scene of some adventure movie. The main character is pulled from normal life and finds themselves on an unexpected important mission. When they return, they slip back into normal city life, perhaps behind the front desk of your local library. I'm Annalise Finney for Cross Currents.
Annalise is a fellow in our Audio Academy training program. Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5 for another story from our At Work series.
Musicians are creative, so they've figured out other ways to sort of get music to people and sometimes get paid in the process, but it's very different.
A musician who's keeping his artistic spirit going tomorrow at 5. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. As a Cuban-Mexican kid growing up in Oakland, writer Aidan Thomas enjoyed hanging out with his friends at the local cemetery. That heritage and those experiences are some of the inspirations behind his debut young adult novel, Cemetery Boys. The paranormal romance centers on Yadriel, a gay trans teenager in East LA. Most of his family doesn't accept his gender, and he's trying to prove to them that he has what it takes to be a real brujo. Yadriel attempts to prove himself by finding the ghost of his murdered cousin, but he accidentally summons the wrong spirit. The book's success makes Aidan Thomas the first openly trans author to reach the New York Times bestseller fiction list with a main character who is trans. KLW's Janae Darden spoke with Aidan, who now lives in Portland, Oregon.
So you're originally from Oakland, East Oakland, where?
Yeah, East Oakland, so Seminary, MacArthur area, and then I went to Mills College, which is basically in the same area, for undergrad and graduate school.
What were you reading as a kid?
Oh gosh, I read pretty much all fantasy. It took like a lot of work for my mom to get me into reading books. I was a very like resistant reader. I didn't have like the attention span for it. But the first book that I like really like madly fell in love with was Howl's Moving Castle by Diane Wynne Jones. And I feel like I kind of got a lot of my writing style from that book because it's fantasy and it's got some like intense elements, but it's also really funny. And so like everything that I write, there's a humor to it.
We're living in a time that I longed for as a kid. You know, the other day I'm reading your book, Cemetery Boys, yep. And I'm watching a black Batwoman. I was kind of bugging out like, whoa, like this is awesome, you know, to have all this representation. So you weren't a big reader at first and then you got into fantasy. When did you start writing?
I started writing probably before I started reading, which I know sounds weird. But when I was like in elementary school, my mom loves to talk about how I was always getting in trouble for not like being focused during class because I was either doodling in notebooks or like writing in my journals. And I guess the first kind of like actual like creative bit of writing I did was that I would write about the dreams that I had and like attempt to turn them into stories. And then when I was in middle school, I really got into like fan fiction.
And Cemetery Boys came from fan fiction.
That's the whole thing, is that like people can be so kind of strange about the writing process and like how you learn how to write and stuff like that. And I double majored in psychology and creative writing. I got my MFA in creative writing, but none of those programs taught me how to write. I learned how to write from doing fan fiction.
So you are a cemetery boy because I understand. What were you doing hanging out at the Mountain View Cemetery in Piedmont, Aiden?
It wasn't just me. First of all, it wasn't just me.
I know.
When I was a teen, it was like a thing to go hang out at Mountain View Cemetery. And it's so beautiful up there. And it has like a view of the bay. It was like a park. Like people would go on jogs and stuff.
I imagine that inspired this book.
Yeah, it definitely did. But then also these really beautiful cemeteries that they have in Mexico City that have these really beautiful houses for urns that look like these brightly painted birdhouses.
As we see more diversity with paranormal fiction by writers of color, it seems we kind of write about death differently, I think. What did you learn about death from your culture?
I think what's really interesting is that death, it's not the end, right? So I feel like for most people, when you think of death, it's kind of like this really sad and kind of depressing, dark thing. Like, it's absolutely a sad thing. There's a lot of grief that goes along with it. You know, you miss the people that you lose. But there's also this deep understanding that it's not the end of their journey or your relationship to them. Because on Dia de Muertos, we get to remember and celebrate those people and welcome them back.
The main character, he wants to be a brujo. And he is, and I know it's gendered as far as the roles. So the women who are brujas, they do the work of healing. And then the brujos, they do the work of communicating with spirits, helping spirits to cross over. And he's being rejected by his family who has this legacy because he's trans. How challenging was that? Or was it painful to write about that too?
I don't think it was painful. I think it was kind of an important unpacking. I wanted to have a magic system that was gender affirming, to really put forth the idea that society doesn't get to decide who you are. You decide who you are. When you know who you are, the magic knows who you are. So that's why Lady Death, who is the patron of the Brujex, she sees Yadriel for exactly who he is, which is why she gifts him with the powers of the Brujos. And what I really wanted to unpack is just kind of this idea that's really common. And I think, like, especially within my community, where sometimes things are done the way that they're done just because that's how they've always been done. This idea of tradition not being questioned and then falling into these really like harmful patterns of like only women can do this and only men can do that. But I wanted to show how the younger generations are the ones who are challenging and pushing and breaking down those barriers.
What's interesting is that the main characters, they're all kind of othered in their community. So like, you know, Julian's kind of he's in the streets. Yadriel, he's trans, and it's hilarious. His cousin Maritza is vegan, and so like, I'm not Latina, but I know in my family it's like, you not eating that chicken?
Yeah, there's chicken in it. Well, chicken doesn't count.
I liked how you use othering in the book with just different categories of othering.
Yeah, I just really wanted to be like pushing on people's expectations. And especially with Julian, because when you're first introduced to him, he is framed in this way of being like, oh, he's like the school bad boy. But then you get to know him more. And again, him being a bad boy is just a societal construct that has been pushed on him because he doesn't fit in at school, because his learning style is not one that's like nurtured or accepted within traditional school environment. And that's a problem that is met up against teenage boys so often, especially boys of color, especially Black boys.
The publishing industry it's very white and very heteronormative. And I was reading that you didn't face as many hurdles getting this book published.
So for the first book that I actually sold is Lost in the Neverwoods. And Cemetery Boys was my option book. And what that means is that when you sell your first book to a publisher, there's an option clause, which means that the next book that you write, they get to see first and decide if they want to publish it. And it was time to start sending my editor my, you know, option ideas. The first idea was like fully fleshed out and I had like 20,000 words written. And Cemetery Boys was the last idea that I pitched, and it was a paragraph long, and most of the sentences ended in question marks, because I was like, and maybe he's trans, and like, well, I don't know, maybe he's also a teenage, and like, I guess he could be gay too, maybe, right? And like, looking back on it, it was really that I was asking her permission to be able to write about my identity, mm-hmm. because I was under the impression that people like me didn't exist in media because I had never seen any of them. And so that meant that people like me and stories about kids like me wasn't like marketable and it wasn't interesting in publishing. And I sent the email at like 6 o'clock our time. And she was like, oh yeah, no, we want Cemetery Boys. That sounds incredible. And I was just like, really? That's the one, huh?
You blew up really yeah. quick. How does it feel?
My imprint Swoon Reads is very small. So I thought that I would just kind of be like this really quiet book. And my whole goal with like writing Cemetery Boys to begin with was that like if I was able to reach one reader and like help them feel seen, then I would have done my job. Like that's all I wanted. And then to suddenly have it be hitting the New York Times bestseller list for multiple weeks, it's been life-changing. It's been wonderful, but also weirdly like the same, like nothing has changed because we're in a pandemic. So it's not like I've been able to like go to any events or meet readers. So like all of this like success has just existed on my laptop. I'm just really looking forward to eventually being able to like meet readers and sign books.
That is weird. What feedback have you gotten from youth about the book?
Gosh, I get messages from young readers who are like, this is the first time I've ever felt seen in a book. Like I related so hard to any number of characters in the story. Yeah. That's such an incredible gift to receive that I feel like anything that I say in response is just not going to hold up to it. But it's been really wonderful. And I've had quite a few folks who have been like reading Cemetery Boys helped me figure out my own gender identity, which is incredible. And I also had a young reader who told me that they named themselves after Julian because they related so much to Cemetery Boys into that book. And that like shook me to my core. That was like so awesome and incredible. I'm like, I'm not worthy of this. I'm really not.
You know, that's the power of art. A YA author had tweeted you. They tweeted because they wrote about a character who was racist, and a reader contacted them and asked them to make the character who's racist more nice. What do you see as your responsibility when readers get uncomfortable?
I would say that it's not my job to make people feel comfortable, especially when this is being aligned with racism. Discomfort is the way that we learn and grow. My biggest priority is always going to be to support young readers, to support young queer Latinx trans readers, marginalized kids. I'm not really concerned with that making other people uncomfortable because I'm not writing for them.
That was Cemetery Boys author Aidan Thomas speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. Aidan's next book is Lost in the Neverwoods, and it's due out in March. This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. We'll stay on the literary scene with a new episode from our podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a socially distanced book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Ori Gutten lives in San Francisco. His children's book, The Butterfly Who Flew in the Rain, came out in November.
It's a story about Cody, a little caterpillar born in the midst of a terrible thunderstorm, in his long journey that follows. Here's one of my favorite parts of the book. As Cody transformed in his chrysalis, the sun came out and gave the earth a kiss. As the sun's warm rays shone down on the ground, all the animals came and gathered round. Cody's cocoon began to snap and crack, and his beautiful wings poked through the back. He quickly broke free from his moon-white shell, and all the animals began to yell. Dancing deer sang with the purest delight. Terrific turtles cheered with all their might. Fancy frogs screamed, "I cannot believe my sight!" And beautiful birds celebrated in flight. All of a sudden, Cody began to cry. "Why do you cry, Mr. Butterfly? Why?" Cody smiled wide and lifted his head. "Before I had only seen rain," he said, "for what seemed like many long and hard years." He paused, sniffling and wiping his tears. "Now the clouds have cleared, the sun is bright, and each of your sweet smiles shines like a light."
That was Ori Gutten reading from The Butterfly Who Flew in the Rain.
New Arrivals is produced by KALW's Lisa Morehouse. Find out how to subscribe to the podcast at kalw.org/newarrivals. And before we go, here's some new music from a local artist. This is a song from LT's latest album, Everything Is Fine. She's originally from the North Bay, but is living in Australia now.
I remember all those mountains caving in. I sat there like Cylon. I was thin, and I feel slightly gaslit, but I know it's not real, oh, it's all in my head. Everything is fine.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Carla Estevez, Ren Farrell, and Marissa Ortega-Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Henat Baba.